Outfitted man.
I'm going to talk about LabKey Server, which is an open source product for scientific data integration. As I said, it's open source. You can go to labkey.org and download an installer. You can get the source code and you can build it yourself if you're a programmer. This whole project is available online. And our company is essentially what we call a professional open source software company. So we get paid by various customers to build software that we then give away. And so we hope that we find more customers who want to do more things. That's the way our business works. I wanted to talk today about scientific data integration and a little bit about how we got to building a platform that does scientific data integration. We've done along the way some literature review. We obviously do architecture as we go, but really where we ended up is because of a set of problems that were set before us, and we've incrementally started solving those problems with an eye to being able to solve more problems like it. So this, what you'll see, evolved over the last 5 or 6 years, and I'm going to talk really in the first half of the talk about how it evolved, what problems we were asked to solve and how we solved them, and what those problems had in common. And then the second half of the talk, I'll talk about how we did it internally, what is the architecture of the system and the data model. And then I'll just brush on future directions at the end. So the first question is, why is scientific data integration important? And from our point of view, we've come from customers with various problems. The first problem is data volume, where people are using high throughput instruments. They're producing hundreds of millions of results, thousands of runs of these instruments. And so what they're creating is essentially what I call long, skinny data, where the data is essentially the same type of data, but they're getting so much of it that they haven't been able to either deal with one run at a time, or more often, they're doing thousands of runs and they want to integrate and compare data across those runs. That's sort of one problem, is that sort of the long, skinny data. The second problem is data variety. So we have people who have clinical data collected, say, as part of observational studies, demographic data that they're collecting about people, wide variety of assays, immunological assays and other assays, and then specimens that they're collecting in the field. And what they want is a system that can help them make sense of all of these different kinds of data together. Each of these may or may not be large data sets, but they are very diverse, they're changing all the time, and they need to be able to go from, say, a specimen to an assay to the assay results and join that in with demographic data about the person who was being stuck with the needle somewhere. The third common thread here is collaboration. Just about everybody we work with has collaborators in their lab and outside their lab. The collaborations are sometimes international, sometimes within an institution, but it's almost never the case that people are using our system to gather data for themselves, to use by themselves. It happens sometimes. But what that means is that you need a secure data sharing strategy so that the right people can see the right subsets of data to get the collaboration done. And that's turned out to be very important. And finally, there's a broad range of analyses that people are doing with this data. And the data, again, the long, skinny data with you know, many millions of results, or these, you know, wide variety of different data types. Now, I'm a little bit apprehensive about talking to this group because my background is in the software industry, not in bioinformatics, and I've been talking to a bunch of PhDs and PhD candidates in biomedical informatics. You know, you might wonder what I can teach you. You know, thinking about this, I thought about a Simpsons episode where Grandpa Simpson gets a job with a bunch of highly educated Ivy League graduates, and the boss comes in and says, you know, let me introduce Mr. Simpson. He has one thing that none of you have. He has life experience. And one of the highly educated people pipes up and says, that's not true. I have a master's degree in life experience. So to me, I feel like I don't have a PhD in bioinformatics, but I have a master's degree in life experience, so maybe you'll be able to learn something from that. So I came from the software industry. I went to the Hutchinson Center to work on some tools for help with biomarker discovery on proteomics data, and went to work for an investigator there. And then from there, we expanded into working with more assays, working with study data management, and lab data management. And I think the evolution of what we did as we moved from very specific types of research into into study data management, into this broader field, and the kinds of work we did that carried over from one area to another, that intersection makes it for an interesting platform for scientific data integration. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to walk you through that and show you the overlap and the kinds of things we built and what we found useful again and again. So the first problem we had, as I said, was doing proteomics for biomarker discovery. And the problem here is this was 2004, 2005. The mass spec instruments were getting really good, and they were able to produce large amounts of data. So you do a run on that mass spec instrument, and 250,000 putative peptides would be found on the mass spec machine. It's more now. And the software that people were using to analyze this data, to take the readings off the mass spec machine, turn them into putative peptides, and then examine that list of peptides, wasn't scaling to the amount of data that they had. At the same time, the Hutch was got this big contract to do biomarker detection using mass spec-based proteomics, and they were going to produce enormous amounts of this data. And they had this analysis pipeline that, you know, took this data and processed it, and that was going to be a bottleneck too. So what we did really the first version of LabKey Server, and it was a system called CPAS, and we built a pipeline to run these mass spec analysis jobs via web browser, and load the results into a database. And then web-based analysis tools, once that data got in there, analysis tools online to view and analyze the results, and I'll show you some pictures of this. And that server is run by the Fred Hutch Cancer Research Center. It's still in use. There's about 90,000 mass spec runs in it, about 700 million peptide identifications in that system today. At the time, we wrote a paper. There's a couple more proteomics papers, but this is sort of the original one that describes what we did there. And just to give you an idea of what that was like, this is actually a graph generated by the system that shows a basic process. So what you've got here is way up at the top there, if I can find my mouse, these are sort of some file inputs to the process. This came out of the mass spec machine, and there's a whole other branch of the tree up there that says how we got from a sample to this file that came out of a mass spec machine. The next thing over is some known proteins. Is there a pointer? Okay, I can do it here. There's some known proteins in a FASTA file, and then settings for how you want to analyze the data. That gets analyzed, it produces some results, that gets converted to another format, a tool gets run to weight which peptide identifications were real, and then those results get run through another tool that sort of tries to figure out the quantities, and those results get run through another tool which attempts to put the peptides together and tell you what proteins were found in this mixture and how much was found or relative to some other mixture. So this is basically the process, and essentially all of those blue ovals up there end up in the database. So now you can do something with this data that's come out of this big pipeline that runs on a cluster of computers. And what you see when you go into your web browser is some of that data put together. So what you can see is here you've got a protein name that was found. Underneath it, there are the set of peptides that were found that are parts of that protein and information on how confident the system thinks that it really found those peptides. And then you can do a couple of different things. You can sort of combine this data and say, you know, at the protein level, tell me more about these proteins. And so you can do something like this, where we do go molecular classification. Here are where the proteins were found. Here's what these proteins do if you group them together. So that's sort of grouping this data even more together. Or you can drill way down on the data, and you can look at one individual scan that came out of the mass spec machine to see whether the process is working right. I don't think people look at these very much, but at the time, they didn't really trust they didn't trust the results as well as they do now. So you could look at these are the individual pieces of the peptide that were found and how much of them were found and whether the blue and red lines are pieces of it, and the black lines are hypothetical ones that you may or may not have found. So this was the first LabKey server. And it did a few useful things. And here's just sort of a summary. There's the data that you see. We had this data pipeline for processing the data. We had collaboration tools so that the scientists could share. This was a multi-site collaboration. And different labs have different areas where they decide to share some of their data or keep some of it private. There was a little bit of integration of specimens. So you could know which specimen went into this process, and then you could attach additional information about the specimens and do analysis on that. Then, of course, the security was there. So this is sort of the first piece of the platform that we did. The next problem we had was flow cytometry. And if you look at this problem, we had a lab. In this case, it was the HIV vaccine trials network, which HVTN. They were doing flow cytometry to identify intracellular cytokines in cells of people who were infected with HIV or vaccinated in a trial. The flow cytometers, really cool instruments that can measure different aspects of cellular function by binding fluorescent things to the outside of the cell and then seeing which individual cells glow in the dark in what colors, essentially. And these machines are getting better and better. Per run quantity of data was increasing. There's a whole analysis again. And it sounds almost exactly like the proteomics problem, really. But there was an important difference here, which is where the proteomics problem, we pretty much knew what kind of data was going to come out. There was a lot of it. In this case, depending on the type of experiment they were doing, different statistics were being spat out of the machine. Well, out of sort of the same statistics were spat out of the machine, but the analysis, they meant different things. So what, you know, what are they looking for in a cell? How are they identifying that thing? And I'll show you a couple of pictures of how they do this. Some of you probably know. So they needed consistent analysis within an experiment type, but they were doing different experiment types. So we had to figure out a way to deal with these different statistics. And so we built this LabKey flow system, which had a flow analysis engine to analyze the data, loaded those statistics. And then the thing that was different here is we had an adaptable data model. So we kind of knew how we were going to store the data, but how we stored the data was not how the scientists wanted to see it. So we were able to show the data that they wanted to see, depending on their experiment type. And then we had a set of query tools to analyze the data so that they could do things like subtract the background of their experiment or compare two experiments or see whether their controls were being consistent over time. Getting all that data in the database allowed them to do that. And we didn't want to have to program all of those queries into the system, so we built a query tool that we or the scientists could use, turns out it's mostly us, to write queries without having to redeploy the software. And this is a paper about the Flow project. So here's an example. This looks kind of similar to what you saw before. And what the guess the difference is up here, these numbers, these columns are of course all defined by the experiment type. So you know, these are like, you know, number of CD4 positive cells, number of CD8 positive cells. These are various gates. And the way that the people who do this type of experiment look at their data, so we can select these columns and say what you want to see. What they're interested in seeing most of the time is the pictures of where those cells were in and how they were labeled. So you can sort of customize the view to show pictures as well as numbers. And just to give you an idea, you know, this little picture shows the live lymphocytes, and then the ones that are labeled this way in this little box are CD3 positive. And then this shows the CD3 positives, and the ones that are in this little box are also CD4 positive, and so on. And so they can get the counts of different kinds of cells, because they're basically looking at different colors, different combinations of colors that these cells glow in the dark. And of course, the interesting thing here is how do you customize this view to get the data that you want in it? And this is something that started with Flow and has been one of the most important things that we've done, which is the ability to have anyone using the product to select data out of the database without writing any SQL code, and they can select data from the table they're looking at, or join tables to that, or join tables to that. So for example, they might know a specimen that went in here, and that specimen might be associated with a subject, and that subject might be have some demographic data, or some other data that changes over time, and so it makes it very easy to join in all of that stuff without writing any queries. Then of course, the other really important thing is, if you need to, you can write a query against this schema, the set of columns that are here, even though you know those weren't initially defined in the database.
Just a question on that. So often when I've seen this done before, where you sort of have a sort of a Lego effect to putting these queries and joining these various tables together, what are the underlying assumptions that you're making about how the data is organized? Like, are they all fundamentally, it all goes back to SQL?
Fundamentally, it all goes back to SQL. There's an interesting thing here that I'll talk about in a little more depth. It goes back to a SQL schema that is a virtual SQL schema. It may not be stored that way on disk. We
sure
present a virtual SQL schema. It goes back to SQL, and essentially what we follow is foreign key relationships.
Okay, and so each of these has probably some required foreign keys, something, each of the tables, and you're sort of assuming that that's there and linking on those.
Yes and no. So it's true when it's that way in the database. When it's in the virtual schema, the programmer can say, I want to present these related columns, and I'm going to tell LabKey how to relate them, what SQL to write to relate them. So it doesn't necessarily have to be foreign keys. it can actually be, you know, fairly sophisticated SQL that gets injected. But when you, you know, click on one of those plus signs and choose something, it's not necessarily a direct foreign key. What we do automatically is if there's a foreign key, we'll show it here. And then it's up to the programmer to define a schema. I'll talk about that a little bit more. So in flow cytometry, you get you know, sort of the same things. We have the data pipeline, we have specimens. They didn't do as much collaboration. Security, they were very concerned with. And then we've got this data variety and the ability to expose a schema that is sort of different from the database that is defined by the user. And the ability to query that. So the next thing we did was actually a little different, and this is where we get to sort of really more of a data integration problem. So we've done this work for HVTN. A group at the Hutch Sharp, which is a statistical center for HIV AIDS research and prevention, they got a contract to work with another group, Chavi, out of Duke, to collect data for some new observational studies. And this was a large multi-year grant, turned out to be 7 years. And they needed to combine many different types of data. So the clinical response forms, so we collected people writing in forms, specimens, many different assays. And what they needed to do, this was a worldwide collaboration, they needed to allow these scientists to view that data from around the world. And it turned out, which we didn't know in advance, probably the thing that the management worried about the most was, if you find someone who's acutely affected with HIV and you collect some blood from that person, that's very valuable blood that every researcher wants to know. They want to know what's happening in the immune system. And so allocating and distributing these rare specimens became, you know, something that was very important to the organization. So we basically extended LabKey Server, and this is where you can see that the investment we did on being able to create different schemas quickly really paid off here, because we could now support these different data types. So we built the secure web portal. It's used by a bunch of different networks. That's Chavi is HIV, AIDS, Vaccine Initiative, CAVD is a Gates Foundation, Human Vaccine Trials Network, Prevention Trials Network. There's even more that are using the same system, about 3,000 users on it. And you know, there are some key things that I'll tell you, but we wrote the core software. We don't run it, so Sharp runs the system called Atlas. They define what the data types are in the system, how they're connected. They manage the security and the permissions and the data loading. And they also, as I'll get to, they build custom modules, different ways to display the data that LabKey doesn't do. There are a couple papers about this, probably Elizabeth's paper, Elizabeth's over here, in BMC Bioinformatics, really gives the most information about the LabKey server and then its use in this context. The simplest summary for what happens with Atlas is you have information coming from a variety of sources. You have a couple of different LIMS systems that are keeping track of hundreds of thousands of vials that are stored in freezers around the world. You've got labs, again, around the world doing various assays. And then you have these forms that people are filling out. And the way that happens is people fill out paper forms. They get, you know, scanned and faxed. And they don't really get faxed. They get emailed into a system that has an OCR reader and people typing in duplicate that the reading is correct. That data also gets loaded in here so that we have the clinical data. And then on the other side, you've got the data viewers coming out. So you've got the leadership of the studies who want to know, you know, what the state is. You've got the labs, which I'm missing a graph for some reason. It's not showing up on that screen. Oh, there it is. So they're seeing some data, and then you've got outside collaborators who are analyzing this. That could include people at the NIH. And so just a few pages of this, a little bit over the next 5 minutes. So here's a study overview, one study, and down here you can see a set of data sets that have been collected. And again, this is all put together by Sharp, not by LabKey, and so various kinds of data sets. So you've got assay results, you've got demographic data, and you can drill into any one of those data sets to view the data online, should you have permission to do so. You know, here's a look at a data set. Kind of looks the same. I can click on an individual participant. I'm not allowed to show you participant IDs, even though they're not bound to anything. And if I look at the participant, here's a page that the folks at Sharp set up that gives me various views of the data that the investigators doing the study found useful, including sort of charts generated in R. Then, as I said, specimens are very important, so you know, I can see what specimens were collected for this subject. And this is one of the things that we sort of added to the data model. It turned out, what are investigators interested in these kind of studies? They're interested in a very small amount of data, application data model that we can track, which is subjects and time. And what data do we have for different subjects over time, whether that's specimens or whatever other, or assay data, they're really interested in organizing it that way. So within the study data model, we attach pretty much every piece of data to a subject and a point in time. And so here's the specimen data from various weeks. I can drill down on that and see details of every vial that is stored in the system. And then there's the shopping cart where there's a whole workflow associated with I'm at a lab, I really want that specimen from that person at that time, so I can ask for it to be put in my shopping cart make an order, and then there's a whole process that needs to be done associated with that, getting approval from various IRBs and material transfer agreements and all kinds of things. So that's sort of the main way to look at it. There's an important process for getting lab data in. So the labs request the data. They run an assay in their lab. They upload the data in some kind of spreadsheet, and sometimes there's an advanced analysis. So the spreadsheet may be 96 wells on a plate, or it might be results that they've already calculated. So there may be some online analysis. They review it, and then they make it available to the rest of the investigators. One of the things we found out here in talking to these labs, a lot of their data is inexact. So, for example, you know, the result may be a number, but because the assay is not sensitive enough, the number that might be returned is less than 20. And we couldn't lose the information that it was less than 20 and not 20. And when we want to be able to show the data as less than 20, we want to be able to sort the data as less than 20. Or if data is missing for various reasons, we want to know why it's missing. So there's additional annotations along with these data items. In addition, there were dozens of small applications done for different groups. LabKey didn't know what those applications would be. The Sharp team knew what they would be. They're in close contact with the investigators. So at their request, we built an API so that they could build custom applications as part of the system quickly and easily, where they get to the data, they present some user interface, and they save it into their own data structures while still using the same data and the same security model. And so we did that. I'll just show you a couple. I did an internal quality control for sample processing that shows, you know, what the quality of the samples collected over time are. And you know, so for the people in the core lab, they really care about this, so they got a custom application for that. They built another application for tracking information about studies being done for sub-studies being done that involve a lot of labs. So they basically had a task tracking and workflow. But again, the data in here, the data that's going in, the data that's coming out, is the data that's stored in LabKey's server. And so I'm not going to go through more of those, but there were literally dozens of those little applications that they built. So what happened? What did we add for this? Well, a couple of things. First of all, specimen management got a lot more interesting here. There are a lot more specimens. I think there's something, well, there's like 800,000 specimens in the study. Security got a lot more fine-grained because some of the data sets, people could see some columns and couldn't see other columns. So for example, some people might be able to see what cohort a subject is in, and other people might not be able to see what cohort a subject is in. Or some people at clinical sites can see data that was collected at their clinical site, but they cannot see data at other clinical sites. So we had to have a security model that supported that. Lots and lots of data varieties, 1,200 different data sets that were they defined. The study data model I talked about with time, custom reporting, APIs, and of course auditing. And so it's sort of like we had two sides of Atlas. There's sort of the study side and the lab data management side. And the last thing I'll talk about, so that I can get to you know how all this works, is an electronic health record for primates. At the Wisconsin National Primate Research Center, they had 30 years of clinical data on thousands of animals. And the clinical staff and the veterinarians need an electronic health record for their day-to-day work with the animals. The researchers needed scientific data. They wanted to collect data over time as more of an analytic system. And then managing the colony, you know, how many animals are there? Where are they? What are they, what, you know, what's the relative health conditions? Where are they coming from? Where are they going to? That was an ongoing problem. So what we realized was that in some ways, an electronic health record is a lot like a study because you're tracking information about individuals over time. And in this case, the individuals are sort of born in the hospital, live their whole lives in the hospital, and die in the hospital. So it's a lot of information. There's information about thousands of individuals every single day, but it's similar to a study. So what we did is we enhanced the scalability of the study solution to be able to deal with millions of rows of data, enhanced the API so that the folks at Wisconsin could build their system, and we wrote tools to migrate their old system to the new one. So what would happen is, as the new system was being built, it would have some of the functionality, and in real time, data from the old system was being transferred in, and then eventually they turned off the old system when the new system was complete. Like I said, we built the underlying platform, and I think this is sort of a bit of a vindication, we didn't build the electronic health record system. Electronic health record system was built on top of the LabKey platform. And I'll just show you one image of this. So here's part of a page with an animal with a problem list. I can't show you the animal, can't show you the problems, and some charts on it. And all of this was built in Wisconsin. Here you're just a little bit different. And like I said, it looks like a study. Has basically the same requirements as study, probably even a little heavier on the auditing side because that's very important to them. And the only difference here really is scale, right? Because they're storing a million doses that have been given to the subjects over the years. So the interesting thing about this, so we've grown from a few things to more in a few different areas to the point where we didn't really have to add new areas to add new capabilities, and we have many clients. And the interesting thing, though, is that we sort of backported those features, and so now the people doing proteomics use the query and reporting modules on their proteomics data, and they use the API to build custom apps. The people in Flow do the same thing. And so basically, I feel like it's vindication that a lot of these things are general purpose problems that we're solving. So, so I talked about what the software does. What are the users want? as opposed to what does the software need to do. The big thing they need to do is integrate data. They need to be able to go from a sample to what assay was it used in, from an assay, back to the subjects, to group them together, and then group subjects together into studies. And there's a quote in a paper that I read, that translational medicine involves integrating data from molecules to populations. And, in one way or another, this software does a bit of that, from, peptides down to, cohorts in studies. So that's, I think, what the users want. The other lesson that they want is they don't know what their data types are going to be. They're going to change over time. So we can't, we have to be fast to grow, and then they don't know what their tools are going to be. They're inventing new analysis over time. So we can't, we can't build that in. We can't be slow. And then the final thing is that the scientists really need to share data. A lot of our clients are involved in multi-center studies. So what did we build? How did we build this thing? This is a Java web application. For those of you who are interested in the programming side of it, it basically runs on all operating systems, incorporates a lot of open source libraries, scientific and non-scientific, that other people have built. And it's extensible via modules, which I'll talk to you about. The data is stored essentially in a relational database server, and we try not to care what database server it is. We've worked with Postgres, SQL, and Microsoft SQL. There's a guy in Australia extending it to work with Oracle, and we wish him the best of luck. He's been doing a great job so far. We've got there's files are stored in network file storage. We've got this analysis pipeline, which you've seen, and then secure access to the data. And the way this kind of looks in the simple sense is that you've got a couple people with their web browsers talking to our web server, and they're getting data from a file system and a SQL database that has lab key data in it. So that's sort of the simplest thing. The reality for a lot of systems is that on the front end, you've got a lot of different things talking to it. You have programs written in SAS or Perl or R or Java, as well as people sitting at their web browsers. And then on the back end, we will connect. A single LabKey server can connect to multiple file systems and can expose data from multiple databases. We don't yet query across those multiple databases, so you sort of have to keep your queries within them, although we do have a query processor of our own, and we theoretically could do that. But I look at this picture, and I think a benefit of LabKey server is a virtue of it is that it's promiscuous, that we will hook up with anything, and that's very good for the scientists because they have a lot of different data systems in the back. So what's the architecture? We start with a data storage layer, just regular relational database and file system. There are some basic services that all the LabKey software uses for security, for getting to the data, and full text search. And then on top of that, there's some experiment services that describe an experiment, what samples went in and what data came out, and possibly what samples came out. There's some basic administration and portal stuff that it doesn't really have anything to do with science per se. And then there's a set of modules, each of which uses those services below to do particular tasks. And those modules might be built by us, or they might be built by other people. What I would say is a special module is the study module that brings together data from all of these different sources. And then on top of that, every request that comes in goes through an interaction layer that enforces security, whether that's via an API or not. So I'm going to talk about how we put it together in a few different parts. So we've got a data model. Security, extensibility, I'll really talk about those three, and then the rest I'll spin through quickly. The data model goals were that we have a consistent user interface, consistent reporting and querying, and seamless data integration, that people can do it without writing code. It has to be extensible. The data types are dynamic and user-defined, and existing data is stored in an external system. And then this last requirement I didn't talk a lot about is that the data stored in it needs to be well annotated. So you can annotate any one of those columns with a concept from an ontology. You can say that something's, they data looks up to each other. You can say that formatting should be applied to a field, a URL, so if you have a gene, when you click on the gene, it can take you to gene cards or some other system. Validation, and then these things that I talked about before, sort of out of range values, which are not natively supported by databases. And then, of course, security in the data layer is very important. So we expose data via a relational model. We were actually quite influenced by the linked data notion that is being used for ontologies and RDF, and we implemented a version of it to annotate experiments. What we found was that really the data we had to deal with was fairly uniform. It was fairly big. A relational database was a good fit for that data, but it needed these annotations to tell you what the data in the database meant. So what we do is we expose this virtual schema that I talked about. So each module can say, here are the tables that I exposed to the user, and that can be different. The tables and columns can be different for every user based on security. And so different people will log in and they will see a different schema, but they can still do full querying about it on it. And users typically query by just adding and removing columns and sorting and filtering in the user interface, but they can do full SQL queries. We have a query processor that supports the full SQL select language, unions and joins and all of that stuff. And our query processor takes that, queries against the virtual schema, and creates a real query against the database. Here's how that works. So basically you have, a custom application on the outside, and it wants to do a query. It can either send a SQL query or say, I want this table and these columns which are in that table or related to it. That gets sent to LabKey server, and the query service takes that query, which is done on this virtual schema, which is for the user, which is limited based on their permission, and takes that query on the virtual schema and translates it to a query on the physical schema on the database, putting in the right filters along the way, and making sure that you're selecting the right columns.
Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you were going to switch to the next slide. Okay. I was just wondering why the query service and translation seems like a lot of work.
A lot of work.
I'm wondering why something like views wouldn't have done the same thing.
That's a great question. And why don't database views do the same thing? And the real answer to that is the security context. What each user can see is defined at the application level, and each user may get to see a different combination of views, so it would be kind of like creating a set of custom views for every user, which we sort of could have done. That's essentially what we're doing, except we're not saving them as views.
Okay.
So we're sort of, the user schema essentially constructs a set of views almost. And the other thing this does is it allows us to keep track of the annotations on those columns, because when you do a query, you're doing a query on an annotated column, not on a native column.
I don't know if we have time, but I have a question about the annotations. Is how are those stored, and what's the variety of things you can do in annotations? Because I'm worried about how it would fit in a relational box.
So the annotations are themselves stored in the relational database, but they're essentially stored using the system that we used for linked data. And so
it's more like an EAV.
So the data can either be stored in physical tables or in an EAV, but it is exposed to the user as if it's in sort of tables in the model that they would like to see. And then the annotations themselves, every column descriptor has a concept ID, which can be a URI into different annotation systems. And they have all these other annotations that we store for every single column descriptor, even though it's not necessarily a column. And so basically, the translated SQL gets sent to the relational database. Tabular data comes back, as relational databases do. And then the interesting thing is that then the query service takes the result of that and re-annotates it. So the query service knows what all the columns went into the query, and basically re-annotates it with, here's what the URL should be for that column, here's the number format for that column, you know, here's when you hover over it, here's a description that should show up when you hover over the column header. All that stuff comes back to the user. So basically, it reconnects the metadata that we are storing in, you know, we are keeping track of in our system with the data that's coming out of it. So that's the data model, and that's really that.
So all the annotations are on the virtual schemas or the views and not on the stored.
That's correct. All the annotations are on the virtual schema.
Right.
And then the major next major feature area, security. I went into this a little bit. The real important thing is it's pervasive. No matter how you get to the data, you get the same security, you get the same data model. That's really important. The other thing that is really important is the easy partitioning of data by security context. So you may have, you know, we need to make it easy to administer this thing. So even if it's you have the same kind of data as someone else that's stored in the same physical table, you don't get to see their data. And so we need to make it easy to partition the data sort of horizontally and easy to administer it. And then we need to be able to make custom modules defining new data types participate in this kind of security without doing a lot of work. This is sort of the model. We divide the user's space up into folders that contain data. Now, usually folders contain files, but in our system, they can contain files that get assigned to these folders, but they can also contain data types. And a data type can span a set of folders and can sort of store data in each folder. And what that really means is that every table in here has a column or can quickly get to a column that is the folder ID or the security context for that data. So it's very easy to filter down the data throughout all the joins. So no matter what data type I have, it can be partitioned this way. And so, you know, people are interested in seeing different things. Sometimes they're interested in seeing data integrated across one folder, right? So they're looking at one study, and they want to see various modalities of data combined. Sometimes they're looking at proteomics data, and they want to look, show me all of the data that I have access to of this type, wherever you found this protein, show me. I don't really care what folder it's in. So that's the other dimension that people might want to look at this data, and basically a filter is applied to the data at that time. And this happens for every request. And the last thing that I'm really going to talk about in any depth at all is extensibility. I talked about a little bit how people had to build their own apps. And really what that means, extensibility means different things to different people. So we've got users of the systems who are creating their own graphical views, administrators who are configuring what kind of data is stored in the system, might be writing custom SQL, so they're customizing the assays. Then you've got application module developers. So these are the sort of the dark green things that I drew on, you know, vertically. So each of these modules, you know, they're going to have some data that they want to share, and we made it easy to build these modules without writing any Java code. A lot of the people who are writing our modules, you know scripting languages, but they don't necessarily know Java. But then you can also build a module in Java. And then there's platform developers, and that's mostly LabKey, a few outside people. We build the core server, some of the important modules, like Study, and then you know that we distribute that online. Just a couple more things, reporting. Was very important. We integrate the R language to do reporting on the server, so someone can write an R report and say, when the data comes out, format it like this and send it to the user. We're starting to work on some interactive reports. So here's an example of one report that someone wrote in R, and here's an example of another one. This is a more interactive one that can be applied to any kind of study data where, you know, you're looking at different data values over time, and you can look at them for different individuals or different groups of individuals. I'm going to skip over sort of file handling. You can connect to it. There's auditing there. Modules can do their own auditing with, you know, whatever audit trail they like. So what are we working on? Because I want to make sure that I have a little time at the end. We've got one of the things we're working on is better out-of-the-box user interface. Right now, you need to have an administrator configure this thing before it becomes useful to your group. We're looking at, you know, some common scenarios that we might be able to help people do out of the box. Some data integration improvements. You know, the one I think that's interesting here, probably for this group, is ID management. You know, one of the common things is people, when they're integrating data, that data has identifiers in it. And those identifiers, you know, identify a gene, or they identify a person, or they identify an analyte, but they're not always consistent. They're not consistent from place to place, and it's really important to have a system that can consolidate them, understand when they're the same and when they're different, and make it easy to get data in. And so that's about it. There's my summary. I don't want to miss the acknowledgments. So how did we get built? LabKey Software, you know, we started at the Hutch, and we this little company that sort of got spun out of a department at the Hutch. So now we're a for-profit company. We have offices at the Hutch, and it was Martin McIntosh at the Hutch who got the first NCI grant, started funding us at the Hutch. And so, you know, he's sort of in some ways the founder of it. And then Steve Self through Sharp, we got into the HIV field, and there are a bunch of funders from the HIV field. David O'Connor's in the HIV field, but he works mostly with primates, so he funded some work. There's someone down at USC, some people at UW, Immune Tolerance Network's a big network. So we get funding from all over. We mostly don't get our own grants. We mostly work with investigators who are doing research and need something, and we help them write the grant. And then they, you know, have us write what they need. And the LabKey development team, most of them are still with us. Two people are in a proteomics lab at the University of Washington. That's about it. Any questions?
How do different organizations and their data, how do you or they choose who's going to participate in sharing the data together?
We don't participate in who's going to share the data. So basically, there's a set of security tools that allow them to add users either from within their organization or from outside, assign them to groups, and then groups can be given various permissions in those different folders, or down to a lower level, you know, for this data set, this group has this permission. For this report, this group has this permission.
So there's a broker that works in between?
It's part of LabKey Server. It's part of LabKey Servers that those permissions are assigned. There's a user interface for administrators to assign those permissions. And then internally, every request, basically we look at what is the resource being requested, which is essentially on the URL. What is the resource being requested?
Requested by?
By the user.
By the user, which is an organization or just?
Just a person.
A person.
A person who's logged in, yeah. So a person will have an individual login. We basically look at the resource, you know, we look at who are you, you know, what's your login, look at the resource. And we look at the permissions associated with the resource and see whether you're in any groups that have the permissions associated with that resource. So it's really sort of every time anybody does anything, there's a three-part question. You know, who are you? What are you trying to access? And what are you trying to do to it? And, you know, basically every request, that those questions get asked.
For the underlying resources, the data that you guys have, they also
With someone's an administrator for each area. So someone gets nominated as the administrator, and they have the privileges to grant permissions. And it's, you know, up to the organization to make sure that they have trustworthy people in that position. But it's really not that different from administering a database or any other website, really.
I think the piece I asked that there are instances of LiveView Server run by different organizations.
Right.
And the organization owns their LiveView Server and administers their own users and their own data. We build a platform, they own the instance.
Right. So we will run LabKey Server for people, but that's not typically what we do.
And then a complete unrelated person like me can go into a certain server, maybe some kind of a central server, and get access to other organizations, or is it just
There actually is not a centralized clearinghouse. You need to know, you know, where the server is. You need to know the web address somehow of where that server is. I think that many of our clients would be fine with having a central clearinghouse. Some of our clients would not be fine at all with having a central clearinghouse. Some of our clients, we're not allowed to say that they use it for, you know, because they're pharma and they're very, and they're very paranoid, even, you know, because they're pharma. That's about it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.